Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Welcome, welcome. So it's episode 7 of Think You Know the Presidents. I'm still Flora McCarthy.
And I'm still Ys Hand. So I can tell that you're excited about today's episode, Flora. I mean, it's all about Mary Robinson, who was Ireland's 7th president, our first woman president, and was elected in 1990 until 1997. And it kind of struck me, you know, that presidents, women presidents, are like buses. I mean, you hang around since the foundation of the state, and then two come along together, two mighty women presidents come along one after the other, with a combined 21 years in the arras between them.
And, you know, we'll be talking a lot about Mary McAleese in the next one, but those words when Mary Robinson won the election and that famous line, "I was elected by the women of Ireland, Manon the Heron, who instead of rocking the cradle, rocked the system." They still reverberate.
They certainly do. And I'm reverberating from that excellent, that absolutely superb impression.
You know, Lise, we've covered 6 episodes already. And of course, for listeners, the best way to keep on top of them is to give us a follow. Right, let's roll up the sleeves of our big girl blouses and get stuck in.
I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage, who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon na Héireann, who instead of rocking the cradle, rocked the system.
You know, I think there is probably going to be a little bit of fangirling.
It stands to reason. We both reported for years on Mary Robinson before her presidency, during her presidency and since. And we've seen her up close and, of course, we're fans.
The seismic nature of her election, you know, to the president. I mean, it really was. The emotions were running so high in the country around that election. Certainly, I'll never forget those days.
Yeah, there was a great line that she said herself about that. So many women cried on the day of my inauguration at the very fact that a woman could be president. So Mary Robinson, born Mary Therese Winifred Burke, was a Mayo woman, and it actually struck me, Lise, we're now finally discussing a president in the present tense.
Oh, isn't that lovely for a change?
Yeah, all the other 7 so far are dearly departed. So she was born in 1944 to 2 medical doctors, Aubrey and Nessa Burke, and grew up in Ballina. She's the only girl in a family of 5 kids, and this is actually quite significant because she had 2 older brothers, Oliver and Aubrey, 2 younger brothers, Henry and Adrian, and she was the only girl, as I said. She was in the middle, but her parents were quite progressive on this.
That's right, they were. She recounts a story, I know herself, of seeing her father come in from delivering a new baby, and he was really angry because when the baby was delivered, he was asked, "Is it a boy or is it a child?" And, you know, so this kind of really put out the notion that inequality was totally undesirable.
Quite a formative thing to overhear.
And apparently as well, she herself was a real tomboy. One of her brothers is actually on record saying she really whacked me hard. So, you know, she was able to deliver a good punch, fair play to her.
So she was sent off to Mount Anvil Secondary School in Dublin, you know, a fee-paying school. And she was a good student there, but she said herself she was quite shy and she forced herself to join the debating team.
But it was funny, when she was at school, she suddenly developed a notion that she might like to be a nun. And yeah, I know.
Shock, horror.
Because she thought sort of, you know, that there was, the nuns were very good, strong on social justice and all that. So she went home.
She did have them in the family too.
Yeah, she did. So she went home and sort of announced this. And her parents, you know, genius move is all I can describe, immediately said, you're going to Paris. Right. So they sent her off to finishing school for a year. And you can imagine the effect that had on a girl.
1960s Paris.
I mean, that's just a genius stroke. I mean, they sent her off to Paris.
That would change you, all right. I mean, I spent a year there myself in my early 20s.
Tell us
more. Yeah, no. But even if you were never planning on entering a convent, it would have an effect on you here in Paris.
So, you know, mind firmly changed. She came home and instead of going to a convent, she decided to go to Trinity College to study law. But an interesting fact is because she was Catholic, permission had to be sought for her to attend Protestant Trinity College from our old pal,
John Charles McQuaid,
who was all over previous episodes for meddling and interfering in various things.
Yeah, and you can also see how that a lifelong effect on her in the law and trying to change these ridiculously archaic rules. So she was a good student in Trinity, you know. I mean, a professor already by the age of 25, Reed Professor of Law. But she had fun too. And, you know, that sense of humour came through. She was sharing a house with her brothers in Westland Row. And Oscar Wilde had lived there. So she used to let the tourists gather outside and then say to them, Oscar is busy.
I'm just loving that impression.
Yeah, she was already going out with Nick Robinson at this stage as well. So both were law students and he'd spotted her apparently in a student debate and pursued her.
Which is lovely. And when they did decide to marry, there was actually, she had opposition from her family because he was a Protestant and he was a cartoonist. And she has talked about this, you know, afterwards and said that It wasn't really snobbishness. They were just very overprotective of her.
A Protestant is bad, but a cartoonist is even worse.
Exactly. I know. It's hard to know which is worse, actually. A Protestant cartoonist. Oh, my God.
What even
everyone's
is that?
Going to hell. But, you know, the great thing is they got married and it was such a close marriage. I mean, they were a real team, a real pair.
And still are more than 50 years later.
And they still are. And, you know, at one stage, later on, he was asked about, you know, is it humiliating for him to be the first husband, you know? And like his reply was brilliant. And it goes to show that he was a feminist as well, because he literally said, look, I'm quite happy to simply make the analogy to countless able women who put their support behind male political leaders. If they can do it, why shouldn't a woman expect the same from her husband?
Brilliant.
Like what a great answer, yeah. You know?
And of course, the first test of that relationship was when she ran off to Harvard.
That's it. And yeah, so she headed off to Harvard, which is, you know, great. But it was just the time she went. She landed in Harvard, bang slap in the middle of all the civil rights movement. I mean, can you imagine going to this place and you literally have, it's all about the Vietnam War. You know, it's literally the country is in a state of turmoil.
The anti-war protests. Jane Fonda in the thick of them.
Yeah, and you know, it would have been coming after things like the, you know, around the time of, you know, assassinations like Martin Luther King and obviously Robert Kennedy and so on. And that must have, no, it did have, we know this because she's spoken about it. It had a massive influence on her. And it just recalibrated her, you know, the thinking she was already doing about social justice and, you know, law being about looking after the small people and making sure for fairness and equality for all. So she came back to Dublin in that mindset.
Interesting that it's whenever she went away, so first to Paris and then to Harvard, yep, that it formed, you know, her
huge
views
part
on the world. And,
yeah,
and she took them and ran with them because not long after she came back, she sees that there's a Senate election, 1969. She's back in Trinity as a young professor and was giving out to her friends saying, you know, why are all the candidates always elderly male professors? So they said to her, if you feel so strongly, why don't you go yourself for the Senate?
Which is great. And, you know, instead of many a good idea that's been had on a bar stool and then, you know, never happens, you know, she went bloody well out there and did it, you know, and became like the, you know, the youngest senator ever elected out of Trinity and a woman. And of course, like once she got in there, she didn't exactly let the grass grow under her feet either. I mean,
she went in there with a goal of changing things to open up Ireland, wasn't it?
Hugely. Yep.
Bring contraception, legalise homosexuality, divorce, all of those she had in her crosshairs.
She did. And, you know, her big thing was trying to liberalise the laws on contraception, which we've talked about previously and were so incredibly tight. But the thing was, you know, she was on this great mission, but not all of Ireland was ready for her and supportive of her. When the contraceptive legislation was in full swing, again, I can't believe we have to mention him again, the Archbishop of Dublin, he who shall not be named. He had a letter read out in every diocese in Dublin that's saying that the bill that she was proposing to legalise contraception would put, in quotes, a curse upon the country. I mean, she was, her parents walked out of Mass because she was literally
in Mayo
because she's been denounced from the pulpit. She got loads of hate mail, and, you know, it ended up with Nick burning the hate mail. And she has said that she, you know, this hurt. She was still young and she found this very hurtful and, you know, quite traumatic.
And, you know, even on her very first day in the Shannon, she came up against this ridiculous rules, and she told this great story about how on her very first day in the Shannon, she was taken aside and it was whispered to her that women should cover their heads. So she had to wear a hat. So she didn't believe it at first, but by lunchtime, the second person had said it to her. So she raced off on her lunch break, bought a beret on Grafton Street and came back in wearing that.
Ah, no.
Because it was her first day, of course, there were photographs and they went into the newspapers. And that photo followed her around, she said, for years. And she hasn't worn a hat since.
But that's a mad rule. I mean, it sure wasn't one of those tricks, you know, like they do in building sites when, you know, the young apprentice gets sent out to buy, a long wait. I mean, it just sounds so utterly ridiculous.
I would say that it was probably the last time that Mary Robinson conformed to a law that she thought was ridiculous. So she was in the Shannon actually for 20 years, 1969 to 89, and she was also briefly a councillor on Dublin Corporation for 4 years.
Yes, she actually ran for the Dáil.
She did
in 1981, and something that a lot of people have forgotten. And I think she was, you know, quite disappointed not to win that seat, but it obviously kind of gave her a taste for the old campaign trail. So, you know, after she left the Shannon, she was probably going to go back into law full time, and that would have been it. But then Labour leader Dick Spring decided to tap her up to see would she be interested in running for the presidency. And she was initially quite reluctant, actually, because she did see it as a bit of a moribund job. And then she was, I think it might have been Nick that said, sure, go away and look, read the Constitution. And of course, Mary, being constitutional lawyer, probably knew it inside out. And she had to think about it and thought, yeah, look, there's actually ways that we can expand this. So she decided she'd run.
Again, she had a plan for how she could make change happen.
Exactly. And this was an important point because she ran in 1990 and Ireland was coming out of a terrible decade. I mean, let's face it, the 80s, as we've discussed previously, you know, everything was really bad.
That is, if you were still living here.
Well, that's a few. Exactly. I mean, during the 80s, something like 450,000 people emigrated. I mean, that's nearly 500,000. And, you know, unemployment was sky high. At one stage, it was nearly up to 18%.
It's repressive.
It was really, and then of course there were terrible things that had happened to women during that time as well. You know, you had the sad, terribly sad case of Anne Lovett, that 15-year-old girl who died giving birth in a grotto in January 1984 in Longford. Mm. Then you had the absolute and utter horror show that was the Kerry Babies case.
Yeah.
Where that woman, Joanne Hayes, was put through the absolute ringer, absolutely disgraceful. Mm. So you just had this.
You had the marriage bar.
And you had the marriage bar, exactly, Floor. So you had this sort of bad time. And then just as she started to run, things were just beginning to tick up. You know, unemployment figures were dropping. There was just a slight change in the mood of the country. There was, you know, good things had just started to happen in Ireland as well.
Do you think she caught that wave, that there was a bit of a momentum in that change?
Do you know, I think she probably did, because just around that time, I mean, you know, we're painting a picture of doom and gloom, but we have to remember some other stuff. I mean, she ran, you know, the election would have been this, you know, the autumn of 1990. That summer was Italian 90.
Like best summer ever.
I went out and bought a green Wonder Bra. Like, this is the God's honest truth. And, like, that's how caught up on it I was. And
a taxi driver told me his budgie died of fright when Ireland scored.
Well, you know what? I can't blame the poor budgie, because I still remember the roars and cheers, you know, like, for it was just the first summer where we really felt good about ourselves. We really did. There we were. The Green Army was out there.
Remember, there were no buses running. There were shops with signs in the windows saying, and watching the match.
And then one of my favourite stories of all, of course, is, you know, they only got to quarter, they got to quarterfinals, But, you know, they got a ticker tape parade on, you know, practically when they came back, you know, double-decker bus and all that. But it gives, you know, that gives you some example of
The atmosphere on the street.
The atmosphere, you know, and it's around this time that, like, Jim Sheridan's film, My Left Foot, two Oscars, you two are riding high.
Mary Robinson campaigning and knocking on the doors, saying, let's keep this change going.
Exactly. So you had that. She's bad things had happened in the 80s and we were just coming out and good things were happening. And I think she caught that wave.
Do you know, I think I've found one person who kind of encapsulates that, and it is a woman called Bridget Murphy. And Bridget was one of the first to volunteer for the Mary Robinson campaign. And she was this quiet, older woman, licking envelopes in the corner of the volunteer office. And it only transpired after a few days while she was there that she had been Hyde's private secretary back in the days in Orison Uachtaráin in the 1930s. But when she got married, she had to leave her job. So she watched as Mary Robinson forged ahead with her legal career. And one of the things she wanted to do, of course, was get rid of the marriage bar. Once this happened, Bridget was in the queue to volunteer for president for Mary Robinson.
Well, that just encapsulate Manon O'Hare and just there. That's a great story.
So it's the autumn of 1990 and we're into the campaign trail, and Mary Robinson with her team are out knocking on the doors. You know, she started on the Berra Peninsula down in West Cork and travelled to probably every village in Ireland. The momentum began to grow, but she still was trailing behind, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she really was seen as just a massive outside chance, and because the clear frontrunner was the then Taoiseach, Brian Lenihan, who was, you know, a massively experienced politician.
A very popular Fianna Fáil.
Very popular, and I mean, a genius at the campaign trail. I mean, this is a guy who knew how to shake hands and kiss babies, you know, and was very affable, big, large and life figure.
And so she wasn't a frontrunner. Obviously, Brian Lenihan was, but then two things happened.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And like the first of these really was of Brian Lenihan's own making, because obviously, in the last episode, we talked about that fateful night where various Fianna Fáil people rang Orison Uachtaráin trying to stop...
Influence the president.
Precisely, trying to stop him from dissolving the Dáil.
And this came back to haunt him.
So in May of 1990, he essentially sat down, did an on-the-record interview with a journalist called Jim Duffy. And he said in this interview that, yes, he had participated in those phone calls to the Aris on that night. When the presidential campaign was up and running... the following September, Irish Times carried a series of articles around this, and one mentioned in passing that Lenin had made one of the calls. So the following month...
It becomes a big story then, doesn't
it? Yeah, but then October, Lenin is in the middle of an interview and on television, and he did a massive U-turn, and he just said that he had no hand, act or part in any efforts to pressurise President Hillary. Now, there's time to sit there going, no, hang on a second. We know that he did.
And it's on tape.
So, of course, next thing, this just completely blew up and it was really confusing. And it was just one of those, like, did he not? Like, what's the story? So basically, it sort of ended up with Lenin going back onto the television on a live, like one of the live news bulletins. And that's when he just turned around and
he stared into the camera. So and into every living room in Ireland.
Yeah.
And said...
But then he said, you know, on mature recollection, he had not phoned Hillary. Like, he still kept onto this line. And, you know, but the tapes were there. Then the tapes came out, that, you know, of him saying, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, we rang, I was involved in that. So it just damaged...
There was no way out of this.
Oh, I mean, it did huge damage to his credibility.
And I remember the line was in the news... Either he was lying to the student, Jim Duffy, or he was lying to us now.
Yeah, I mean, it was a no-win situation.
Not presidential. So the nail in the coffin of his presidential campaign really was the second thing that happened, and that was at the hands of one of his own colleagues, Fianna Fáil TD Pádraig Flynn, who was on air, again on an RTE television programme, Saturday View, and Flynn launched a very personal attack on Mary Robinson, and it backfired spectacularly. So do you remember what he said?
Oh, yeah, the words are etched on my soul.
Her new clothes and new hairdo and newfound interest in the family. He said, you know, none of us who knew Mary Robinson in previous incarnations ever heard her claiming to be a great wife and mother.
And you can clearly hear on the audio, like PD politician Michael McDougall literally splutter. That's outrageous. And that was a view that was literally echoed in households all around the country. That was, I think, the moment where Manon and the Heron decided to go on the march all the way to the ballot box.
Exactly. I love what Bride Rosny, Mary Robinson's right-hand woman and friend, her reaction.
After the election, she sent a big bunch of red roses to Pádraig Flynn, literally saying, you know, the women of Ireland, thank you. I mean, talk about top trolling.
So in the end, the election was closer than was predicted, but Mary Robinson beat Brian Lenehan. Austin Curry swept into power in the Oras and made it really clear right from the start that she was going to do things her own way.
She did, because, you know, one of the very first places she turned up was on RTE's The Den. And for anyone listening, The Den really was the only show in town. It was just anarchic television with really badly behaved puppets shouting the odds and Ray D'Arcy trying to keep control on them to absolutely no avail whatsoever. It was great crack altogether.
And Zig and Zag.
Yeah, with Zig and Zag and Dustin, literally just before, like, her inauguration. And she's sort of sitting there and she brought a load of cards of children, right, which, you know, she read out congratulations cards. And again, this goes into the sort of see it, be it, because one of the cards is from a 7-year-old and who said, I want to be president when I grow up, you know. So already she was becoming a role model. But of course, it was the usual controlled chaos in the studio. Dustin came in and introduced himself as like, ah, there you are, Mercer. It's just like Mercer, right? And there was all this back and forth about smelly feet and, you know, just the general mayhem. And she just sat there. And I remember watching that and thinking, God, we're in for a different president now.
Yeah. And, you know, already on inauguration day, she was doing it again because as she was about to sign the oath of office, a civil servant apparently came over and whispered in her ear that she had to sign Mar Vic Robin on the signature line. She wrote Mary Robinson.
There was no messing. And, you know, we look back at her inauguration. One of the things that strikes me so strongly about it is, you know, there was this woman wearing the sort of vivid kingfisher blue surrounded by all these suits. And I think all men in suits. And I just remember looking at Taoiseach Charles Haughey. Like, Fianna Fáil had now lost the presidency, which they had held the whole way through the history of the state. Mm. And he has, and I can only describe it as like a face like a well-smacked arsenum. He really was, you know, not happy.
Thunderous.
Thunderous. And I think he also knew that this was not going to be the kind of woman that was going to sit quietly up in the arras and behave herself.
And that's how it continued, because there's a great story about one of his first visits as Taoiseach up to the arras to brief the president, Mary Robinson. And with him, he had a huge file and he was going to tell her what her role was and wasn't, until she reminded him that she was a constitutional lawyer. And apparently he dropped the file on the floor and threw his arms up.
That's right. And she's on the record of actually saying that, you know, two of us left that room, but only one of us was smiling.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
After the election, Mary and Nick Robinson, and of course their three children, Tessa, William and Aubrey, so they move into the park, and from the very off, our first female president was getting stuck into delivering on all her various campaign pledges.
Rolling up her sleeves.
And I tell you, it was some list. I mean, she wanted to bring in new ways of doing business in the Oras. She wanted to promote inclusivity among marginalised groups all across Ireland and across the border. And also highlight the plight of people like in countries ravaged by famine and war.
So she was doing what women do best then, multitasking.
Yeah, I tell you, no better woman for it.
Well, one of the first things she did was put that famous lamp in the window, you know, for the diaspora. It, as we were saying, was a time of serious emigration. A lot of young people had gone in particular. So she was starting a tradition with that that continues today.
And isn't it true that they wouldn't allow her to use candles? Isn't that right? She wanted to put a candle in the window, but apparently it was a fire hazard.
Ah, yes.
So herself and Nick went off and got a lamp designed that had no off switch. So this lamp with no off switch never went out, was put in the window.
And that actual lamp is in the Mary Robinson Centre in Ballinana.
That's where she grew up. I didn't know that.
So she also threw open the doors of the Oras to women's groups, to travellers' groups, to LGBT groups, and made sure that all of these groups were welcomed to Oras Nuachtarán.
Which was kind of a first, you know, this notion of just sort of throwing open the doors to everyone. And, you know, she was a bit of a, I suppose she was a woman on a mission, wasn't she?
She was, yeah, multiple missions, really. And some of the ways she went about doing business, you know, in a new way caused consternation along various corridors of power, didn't they?
Yeah, but I mean, that's what she was there for, was to start causing consternation. I mean, you know, obviously she was going to start ruffling feathers because she wasn't prepared to just pick up where Paddy Hillary had left off and kind of keep a low profile and keep her head down. And we've more or less had a fairly early example of this fairly early on in like her presidency in March 1991, where she started butting heads with the government over a visit. Now, it wasn't a state visit or anything, obviously, but of the Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso. He was a leader of the Tibetan government in exile. And he was over in Ireland to visit the Chester Beatty Library, and Mary Robinson had planned to meet him there. But of course, this caused massive consternation in government circles because they were afraid that it would be seen as a slight against the communist government of China, who, of course, you know, had claimed an entitlement to incorporate Tibet into their own republic. And a blizzard of letters apparently arrived, well, at least three, to the Oras on the day before, kind of going, this would not be helpful. These all came again from the office of the Taoiseach, Charlie Haughey. Wouldn't be helpful. And, you know, really trying to put her off this visit. And she said afterwards, she said, I was almost fainting with worry. So, I mean, it just goes to show that she knew that this was her.
She was going against
the constitutional boundaries and going against a very tough Taoiseach as
well.
And, you
know, the first serious crisis of her presidency was another one of those where she was ordered not to go. And this was Belfast. So Robinson was due to meet community groups and Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams would be in attendance. In a letter in June 1993, then Taoiseach Albert Reynolds warned Robinson to reconsider the advisability of her planned trip to West Belfast. 2 days later, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Patrick Mayhew, sent a stronger warning saying that the President would be going against his specific advice and might endanger life. This was really serious stuff.
That's pretty strong. I mean, saying might endanger life, I mean, that's really putting it up to her.
It really was. She ignored those warnings. She went ahead with the trip. She shook hands with Gerry Adams. Within months, though, Lise, Albert Reynolds had done the same, shaking hands with Gerry Adams. Eventually, there was an historic handshake between Queen Elizabeth II and Martin McGuinness. Robinson knew what she was doing.
Yes. I mean, I think this is the great thing about Mary Robinson is that she just, when she decided to do something, you know, it was like nonetheless she persisted. I mean, this was a woman that would not back down when she was told to, you know, to back down, essentially. And she was also a constitutional lawyer, which we've talked about before. So she sort of knew where the line was.
She
was able to dance up to it, but not necessarily cross it.
Description. And even on her international trips, you know, again, there was a question about, was it the president who should be going to Somalia when there was a famine, or going to Rwanda after the awful genocide there? She was the first head of state of any country in the world to visit Rwanda after the genocide. In 1992, she paid the first of several visits to Somalia after that desperate famine. Immediately afterwards, she wrote to more than 80 world leaders calling for assistance for the Somali people. And I found a wonderful letter, actually, from Seamus Heaney. So she'd given, do you remember there was a press conference after she left Somalia?
Oh, that famous press conference.
Famous TV press conference on the news. And it's the one at which she started to cry. So the emotion of witnessing famine unfold in Somalia over a 3-day visit got to her when the television cameras were rolling.
It has been a very difficult 3 days, very, very difficult. I found that when I was there in Baidoa and in Afgoy and in Mogadishu and this morning in Mandera, that I had no difficulty in remaining calm and in not letting my emotions show. And I'm sorry that I cannot be entirely calm speaking to you, because I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for.
She was very annoyed with herself afterwards.
That's right. She said she was very disappointed in herself.
She was, for showing emotion. But there was one Irish journalist who was in the room, actually, in Nairobi, who had been giving her a lot of grief in his articles. And apparently he wrote 3 words on a little note, passed it to her press team, and it just said, "You were magnificent."
Well, you know, she was magnificent. He was right. And it also, there was no reason why she should have felt disappointed in herself, because what that really did was helped melt that kind of frosty image that an awful lot of the public had of her as this sort of stern constitutional lawyer that was always very self-contained. And there she was, just doing something massively human. She was, you know, she was crying. And it was interesting, because one of the people who reacted to that was actually Queen Elizabeth. And a letter arrived later that year from the Queen's private secretary, from Sandringham. And in the letter it said, "The Queen shares with the distress she feels at the dreadful situation in Somalia." So even Queen Elizabeth just picked up on that. And of course, then the next year, we have a situation where Mary Robinson becomes the first head of state to visit Queen Elizabeth.
Ah, yeah. So that reputation was working away in the background. You know what you were saying there about the sort of frosty reputation that she had?
Yeah.
Mary Robinson has a brilliant sense of humour, and she said, I was lucky enough to interview her this time last year when her documentary Mary Robinson came out, and she danced literally onto the stage in a cinema full of women considering running for politics, and she was telling all these great stories. And one of them asked her, had she any regret in her public life? And she said the main one in how she conducted her public life was that she didn't use humour more. She said, "I learned from Desmond Tutu, a little humour goes a long way."
Okay, that's a bit of spectacular name dropping. Yeah. But, you know, it does also feed into that thing about a woman in a high role like that. She was her first female president. And she probably felt that she had to be stern and self-contained. And
more serious than the men.
Yeah, like that age-old tired trope that, you know, women are too emotional to be in politics and women are too emotional to run companies and so on. So there probably was a little element of self-restraint there as well, that she felt she couldn't be possibly what would be seen as frivolous. And she probably had to maybe tamp down some of her natural kind of funniness. So obviously, you know, there was a bit of correspondence going back and forth between the palace and the arras. And it was actually on her 49th birthday, which was May 27th in 1993, Mary Robinson popped in for tea with Queen Elizabeth in Buckingham Palace. And this was the first time an Irish president had actually set foot in Britain. I mean, we just had the last time talking about President Hillary and the way that the government declined to allow him to go to Princess Diana's wedding. So anyway, Robinson just said, "I'm not going to be pushed around by the Irish government." And she just said, "No, this is actually an important thing to do." So off she went, and they had a 30-minute cup of tea and exchanged presents. But most importantly, there was photographs. So after that, it was photographs of two heads of state. And this was the important thing, because they were there as equals. And this was a huge statement, that Ireland had a female head of state and there was a head of state, you know, the Queen was...
And the national anthems of both were playing in the courtyard of Buckingham Palace.
Precisely. So next thing, we are now equals. And this was a really important message to send at that particular time.
Do you remember she was at the centre of a bizarre verbal attack following the visit to the Vatican in 1997? So in a letter to the Irish Times, a young priest based in Rome criticised the president for not dressing in black, as was customary during state visits. He described she wore a dark green dress, which he described as cheap. And then he called those defending Mary Robinson "Oris lickers." He got just about everything wrong. this was a private visit. It wasn't a state visit, so she could wear whatever she wanted. The usual dress codes didn't apply. She didn't break protocol, and the church sided with the president.
Not surprising. I mean, this is another example of that sort of sexist thing. You had another incident where an army private got reprimanded and fined because she was coming down a guard of honour, and he turned to one of his friends and says, "Here comes Big Bird," because she was dressed in yellow. You know, cue laughter, somebody overheard, and next thing he's in trouble. So when you sort of look at a lot of the things she did during her presidency, I mean, it was very clear that her heart was sort of in the big global picture and she cared an awful lot about humanitarian things. So, I mean, I suppose it was no surprise, really, when she announced that she'd landed, you know, a big job as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. But the big surprise was that she left early to do so.
Yeah, she did. So she describes it herself that Kofi Annan had been pressurising her to leave. Her presidency term wasn't due to be up until November, and this was the summer. And so she was coming under pressure. It was a natural next step, an obvious next step, given all of her human rights work. And now she was a big figure on the international stage for this. So becoming UN High Commissioner for Refugees was, you know, a great move. But she regrets leaving the presidency early. She regrets resigning. And she got a lot of flack for doing so. People felt, oh, you're now too big for your boots. You're turning your back on Áras Na Uachtaráin and the Irish people.
I wonder, though, has she been a bit hard on herself at the end of the day?
It was because only a few weeks. It was only a few weeks.
It was a massive job. And also, when she left, her popularity rating was in the 90s. So this wasn't seen in the public as necessarily a massive snub.
It was the highest popularity rating of any president. So yes, she has expressed in several interviews her regret of resigning early. And years later, I suppose the other big regret of her career that she's spoken about was in 2018, when as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she went to Dubai and Princess Latifa al-Maktoum of the royal family there was trying to flee her family, actually. And Mary Robinson went on record saying that she was a troubled young woman, later realising that she had been tricked.
That's the thing, isn't it? We could literally fill another episode on what Mary did next. I mean, unlike every other previous president who sort of faded from view once they left the Áras, like, she is still out there. She's still fighting the good fight as a global human rights warrior. I mean, only last year at COP26, the Climate Justice Summit, in one fell swoop, she literally called out the Vatican, Russia, Saudi Arabia and Azerbaijan for dragging their heels on gender issues and kind of moving away, you know, from fossil fuels. So, I mean, she's some woman for one woman.
You know what? I saw a fantastic interview with her not so long ago in which the interviewer said, "So, what should I call you? Is it former President of Ireland? Is it former UN High Commissioner? Is it current Chair of the Elders?" Her response, Mary.
Ah, lovely. Well, as Zig and Zag told her on the Den, you're historical Mary, which I love. But, you know, she made history. She energised and she inspired so many generations that came behind her of young women and Manon Aheron. And, you know, it's actually surely no coincidence that she left such an imprint that the 1997 presidential campaign, 3 out of the 4 candidates were women, including next week's president, Mary McAleese.
And they became the first 2 successive women elected head of state in any country in the world.
Next time,
2 or 3 years into our presidency, there was, at least you're going to laugh at this, but I was at a ceremony in Cork for the Cork Person of the Year. It was one of the nominees.
Were you up for it? Yeah.
I was right.
Did you win?
I didn't win, of course not, because somebody far more worthy and deserving won it.
You've been listening to Think You Know the Presidents, a Today FM production presented by The Last Word.
Presented by Lise Hand and Flora McCarthy. Researched by Lise Hand, Flora McCarthy and Siobhan Maguire. Recorded by Thomas Balfe. Sound designed by Neil Kavanagh and produced by Siobhan Maguire.
You can follow us on Go Loud, Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy what you hear, do please like and leave us a review.
Hey, Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.